We're on the 8th chapter of Mosiah, and it's absolutely staggering what's in here. I've been missing everything all these years. We can't stop for everything, but nevertheless, it's jammed in here. Let's go to the 8th chapter now. Now, here, remember that Ammon has come to Limhi kingdom, and he's been invited to speak to the king. He's in the palace now, and it follows strictly the proper palace procedure, as you get in all the epics and so forth. Limhi makes an end of speaking. He tells his story, and then he invites the guest to speak and tell his story. This is a theme that's common in epic, of course, when Odysseus comes to the Phaeacians. The king of the Phaeacians is Alcinous, and he gives a long speech that runs through two books explaining how they happened to get there. And then he says to guest as he's about to leave at the beginning of the 9th book, he says, now tell us your story. And so Odysseus starts out, I am Odysseus, the son of Laertes, noted throughout the world for my sufferings, everybody watching my sufferings, and my fame goes to heaven. And I live in Ithaca, and he describes what a beautiful land it is. It's rough, but it's a good land, a nourisher of people rather than nothing. Oh, the way it skips along is a marvelous thing. Then two lines later, he tells how he, see, I've been looking at this morning. He tells us two lines later how he was trapped, how he lived for 10 years with the nymph Calypso. En spacey glafaresi lalaimene posseneni. I said easier, had a drink. But how beautifully it skips along. Uto agoge haeskaies. So he tells his story, and the same thing happens in the story of Dido and Aeneas. You Latin people remember that. Aeneas comes to Dido's kingdom. Dido was the queen of Carthage, North Africa. They have come from Phoenicia back in the year 800, and when they came, Dido and her sister settled there. Melissa, wasn't it? And she tells her his story. She tells her story first. How dignara mari miseris securo disco. We've suffered a lot, so we know how to accept and be kind to somebody else. And then she assures him, we're not as uncivilized as you think. Nec tamuersa se quos tyrias sol yugit aburbe. The sun doesn't yoke his chariot as far away from Troy as you think. We have some cultivation too. And then Aeneas tells his story and so forth. So this is the procedure. So we had to go to that, you see. So Limhi tells his story, and then Ammon tells his story. He stands up before the multitudes and delivers a formal discourse and tells what it is. Now, he gives his report by invitation, and he tells, remember, he clues them in on the last words of Benjamin, what's been going on in the old hometown. And after he'd done this, the king dismissed the multitude. Everybody had been there, and they all went home. No, it's small stuff here, but it's big. You use exactly the same vocabulary, exactly the same sense you do with small groups that you do for big. I've been thinking about the Hopis, and it's so very true. Everything they say here, I have reference to them, their migrations, their cities, their wars, and so forth. So much like this. Well, it happens now that Limhi's people had kept a record of a minor migration. These people are always migrating, always meeting, joining, separating, fighting, and so forth. This is the story, and they keep records of it, too. That's the four Hopi stones. I'll mention that later, because I'm one of the very few people that ever seen the real one, the big one, and they showed it to me on two occasions. The plates which contained the records of the people from the time they left the land of Zarahemla, see, the Hopi stone number four, is a very careful record of the migrations up from the south, from the Great Red City in the south. I think it's maybe have been Palenque. It wasn't, but Red City, of course, Zarahemla. They left the land of Zarahemla, should be brought before Ammon, that he might read them. So he reads the record, too. And Ammon, as soon as he read the record, he says, by the way, do you know anything about languages? How to interpret languages? And the king said to him, well, tells him the story about the plates, how they got these 24 plates. He wants them to read. Where was this land of many waters? Was it the Great Lakes country, which is great in metallurgy, because they found all these breastplates of bronze and so forth. They found them there. And it was great copper works, remember, up around, way up around that, not just the Mandan country, east of that, around the Great Lakes, been found prehistoric metal work in great abundance. They mined those iron and copper mines up there in prehistoric times. But he tells us how how it happened. Desperate for relief, the king was, the seventh verse he tells us that, said unto him, being grieved for the afflictions of my people, they're all we could take. Let's go back and see if we can get some help from the old country. They're going back and find Zarahemla, but they've been gone for three generations now. Would they be able to find it? And he looked to Zarahemla for aid, the mother city, which colonies always do. And then he said to him, by the way, can you read these things? And incidentally, the interesting thing about these people that have kept their records and their legends and so forth, you can check them because they left their marks everywhere. That's what these glyphs are. The tribes have their particular marks. And they cover vast distances. They don't think of anything of crossing the country. When first here, all during the 40s and 50s, all our Navajo and Hopi students, we were very primitive, poor in those days. They would walk home and think nothing of it, to walk back to northwest Arizona, northeast Arizona rather, and to New Mexico. They'd walk home for vacation and walk back again. They could get rides too, but they thought nothing of walking. So these people really cover distances in this. So don't worry about Book of Mormon geography. I'm not going to worry about that or even talk about it, because it's endless points of argument. Well, they took a journey. 43 people, that's the size of a company, of a troop, you see, and they, to find the land of Zarahemla, and instead of that, they found where the Jaredites had been, and among many waters with the ruins of buildings and the 24 plates of pure gold. And he says, can you translate them? Now we come to the mystery of language. What do you mean, translate them? Translate them in general? See, I've been writing some stuff down here. Some people can actually have that gift. You have that gift. Canst thou translate? Well, what do you mean? Which languages? Translate how far and so forth. Well, there are people who can do that. George Smith did it at the British Museum. He could read Babylonian tablets before anybody could read them. He just knew what was on them, and it turned out he was right when they finally deciphered them, because he just stacked hundreds of them in the British Museum. The same way with Llewellyn Griffith. He could read Meroitic, the Book of Mormon Egyptian. And nobody else, his students couldn't, nobody's read it since, but he could do it, we know now, because we have parallel texts and so forth. Some people have this gift. And as a matter of fact, just last week, there was a remarkable manifestation of gift of tongues in the Provo Temple. I won't go into that. My daughter and son-in-law were there, and it was most astonishing what happened. Oh, by the way, we have papers. Well, I can confide so much in it. It had to do with the sealing of names of a very ancient Chinese family, going back to 200 A.D. And my son and daughter, son-in-law and daughter, had just got back from China. They had on a short assignment back there, and they'd picked up these names and got permission overnight to do the work. It was not very unusual. They just sent it right, because these were very important people. But anyway, it was Cantonese. Nobody speaks Cantonese. Mandarin is what everybody learns in Chinese, but Cantonese is vicious, you know, they can't do it. And here this little old man from Provo, never been out or anything else, had this long list of Cantonese names to read off. Now, I was there when they did the work for a lot of Illyrian or Dalmatian royalty, the coast, the Croatian coast there. And the sealer was a professional linguist, and he had an awful time with those names. But this man read off these long, at least three parts to each name, these long Cantonese names, without one slip, in a perfect Cantonese accent, without one moment's hesitation. That was a remarkable demonstration. I couldn't hope to do it in a million years, a thing like that. Well, but there was much else happened beside that. We won't go into that. It was quite a session. We have them every once in a while. There is such a thing then as gift of tongues. It comes and goes. Those who deal with languages know that. So it depends more largely on faith than anything else. If you lose your faith and confidence, the page will be perfectly blank to you. The days when you've had a good sleep and feel gung-ho, it's easier than English. You say, why did I ever stop at this? It's the way it goes. And they want to know the cause of their destruction. What can this tell us about destruction? Notice always that theme in the Book of Mormon. How do people get destroyed and so forth? And then Ammon explains this business about seers. I can assure you, King, that this is a gift from God. You see, we know a man, that's back home, of course, that's Messiah, who has a gift from God, and he can interpret. And all things, and the things are called interpreters. Well, the gift, of course, are the Urim and Thummim of ancient date, and no man can look at them except he's commanded, and he should look, but he should, ought not, he should perish, very dangerous, lots of power. Whoever is commanded to look in them is called a seer. And behold, the king of the people who are in the land of Zarahemla, he has the high gift. Now, it's very interesting. The oldest and highest office held by the Pharaoh was that of the Matweru, means the great seer or the greatest of seers. The title appears in both ways, the Ma or Ma'a and Weru, the great seer. Well, you write it this way. But these things are the two stones he sees to see with. He was the high priest of Heliopolis, the oldest, the original center in Egypt. The high priest of Heliopolis was the On of the Bible. On, as the name shows, it was the ancient observatory, and he was the great seer, the great observer, the great seer, in which he saw everything, but he did with these two stones. I say, that's the oldest title that Pharaoh has, and it's the great seer of Heliopolis, because he has the gift of seers and the two stones and so forth. It's an old tradition. It's quite one, and that's what he's referring to here. And it comes us up in a very striking way in the Book of Ether, which comes later on, which is archaic. A seer is a revelator. A gift is greater no man can have. A seer can know, notice, things that are past and present and future, things which are to come. As Homer says, Oneropolos ochoristus os eden tadesomenai proteonta, todeonta, todesomenai prodeonta, of things that are, of things that shall be, and things that were. The greatest of seers, ochoristus, means the best, the most confident, the ablest. Oneropolos ochoristus os eden tadonta tadesomenai proteonta, the things that are, the things that shall be, tadesomena, and the things proto that went before. So that's the gift of the seer. He knows all these things. And notice, this knowledge is a great blessing. Hidden things come to light, things that are not known, things that may be known to them, things shall be made known by them, otherwise they could not be known. This knowledge, of course, it's by revelation, and it comes through faith. And this is a marvelous verse, this 18th verse. This really packs a punch. While I'm here on this subject of knowledge, since I took the trouble to lug the darn book up the hill, I'm going to read what Brigham Young has to say on this particular subject, why we are here, the great importance of knowledge. There's a reference later on that's very important that comes in this very story. Well, here we go then. Brigham says, what will feed and clothe you? Will education feed and clothe you, keep you warm on a cold day, or enable you to build a house? Not at all. Ho-ho. Is he ever wrong? He should come around today. Should we cry down education on this account? No. What is it for? The improvement of the mind, and he underlines the mind. To instruct us in all the arts and sciences, in the history of the world, in laws on how to be useful while we live, in the things of the mind that are greatly useful. Truth, wisdom, power, glory, light, and intelligence exist upon their own qualities. Now, this Brigham, remember, he'd only been to school 11 days in his life. He was an uneducated man, but he was the best speaker of his time. He never made a note, remember. Nothing is written down. It's all from the cuff. He has people eager to take it down. But he flings these things out, and this powerful, vigorous, straightforward, very moving prose. He never drops his style. A marvelous gift, you see. He had a gift. Truth, wisdom, power, glory, light, and intelligence exist upon their own qualities. They do not, neither can they exist on any other principle. Truth is congenial with itself, and light cleaves under light. It's the same with knowledge and virtue and all eternal attributes. They follow each other. Truth cleaves unto truth because it is truth, and it is to be adored because it is an attribute of God, for it is excellence, for its excellence for itself. Like truth, like knowledge, it is an attribute to God himself. There can be no ulterior motive in the study of heavenly things. You see, knowledge is power, is the slogan of a rascally world, he tells us. What do you love truth for? Is it because you can discover a beauty in it? Because it's congenial to you? Or because you think it will make you a ruler or a lord? Knowledge, power, see Bacon. Bacon was a very ambitious man. If you think that you will attain to power upon such a motive, you are much mistaken. It is a trick of the unseen power that is abroad amongst the inhabitants of the earth that leads them astray, binds their minds, and subverts their understanding. Well, he goes on, and that's, it's a long discourse. We won't go into it here. But this is the point, you see. This knowledge is a great blessing, whether we believe it today or not. There are other things we'd rather have, you see, than knowledge. And, unless it's knowledge that will make you rich, the knowledge that comes by in the stock market by previous knowledge that slipped to you by somebody who works in the office. Thus God has proven a means, that man through faith can work many mighty miracles, therefore he becometh a great benefit to his fellow beings. But it's all through faith, and it actually is something that couldn't be done without faith, which is miraculous, and they're very beneficial to the human race. That's a powerful statement. And then God wants us to ask, and he wants us to know. Ammon made an end of speaking. He said, doubtless a great mystery is contained in these plates, and the interpreters were doubtless prepared for the purpose of unfolding all such mysteries to the children of men. How marvelous are the works of the Lord, and he goes on. Here is the way people, I say, but are we interested? Well, this is how we react. People react to that. Now, this is a remarkable thing. Occasionally we have breakthroughs in the Book of Mormon of what's known as the wisdom literature. Recently, it's the big thing. It's the thing more articles are written and studies today about than anything else in Egyptian and Hebrew, because showing that Egyptian and Hebrew wisdom literature are the same. Way back years ago, Ehrman, the great Ehrman, discovered parallel passages and whole speeches, Proverbs and so forth, that's in Egyptian Ammonimit. He hid it. He was ashamed of it because this shouldn't be. The Egyptians and Hebrews shouldn't be in like that. But today, everybody's getting on the bandwagon, and the Hebrew wisdom literature and the Egyptian wisdom literature are very close, and then you have the Sophia, the literature of the Greeks. But the idea is interesting here, that how blind and impenetrable are the understandings of men. Why? Because they're stupid? No, for they will not seek wisdom. Neither do they desire that she should rule over them. I think it's an interesting thing that wisdom, which is Chokhmah, which is Sophia, which is always used all over the place as Sophia, and Mat, or anything you want to call her. What else we got down here? Wisdom, anyone that occurred to you. Wisdom is always personified as, the Norns, you have this here, as a woman. She's always personified, even in our scriptures too. Here it is. Sophia Mat, Athena, of course. You all know about Athena, who is wisdom personified. The ancient axiom explaining that is that wisdom is feminine, is Mother Earth, the wisdom that comes to the Norns. Remember, Mother Earth, Erda, speaks Weisheit, Raunend, Ransein, Gavel, speaking wisdom. Her sacred spring ran, and you went to the sacred spring to consult it. And the Sibyls and the oracles, the Delphic oracles, they're all women, you see. They hold the secrets. With the Egyptian, Seshat, her name means secret. She held the secrets to the knowledge that the men wrote down and so forth, but she was the bookkeeper. She held control of things. You always have the woman in here in control. And so, and the oracles, and of course the perversions in witches, which are always superior to wizards, and this, that, and the other. But this bit of wisdom literature is nice here, because it's true. They will not seek wisdom, should be capitalized, neither do they desire that she should rule over them. There is a wild flock that fleeth from the shepherd and scattereth and are driven and devoured by the beast of the forest. Well, here's a parable, but what is the beast of the forest in this particular case? Well, from the very beginning, there are monsters. Aristotle does it very well at the beginning of the Metaphysics. He says, why do we study these? Why do we do things? He's because we know darn well that if we don't, we're in real trouble. What you don't know can scare you. It can scare you. See, it's the distant drum. It's the thing that's, William James defined intelligence as the ability to react to an absent stimulus. See, a bug, if you touch it, will react, or a mouse, or anything like that. But a person who thinks, he reacts to an absent stimulus. He can hear the rumble of a distant drum. He can hear the danger of the flood water up the... Animals have that gift too. They have it instinctively, some very remarkable cases. But in these cases, the idea that the beast is waiting for you out there, if you don't, the beast of the forest. See, this goes back, you might say, to prehistoric memories. It's an atavism, so to speak. The there are monsters out there. And in prehistoric times, they were monsters, and they live on in fairy tales and so forth, in the gnomes and the trolls, and Tolkien capitalizes on it, and the ancient folk tales and so forth. That if you don't, well, he says it's a what seek for knowledge is really a fuge apotes. What does he use the word for ignorance? Agnosia. It is agnosia. See, it's flight from ignorance. You're scared of it. It's like ignorance is something like pushes on you in on you on all sides, and a suffocating, I'll say an airbag or fog or something. Yes, you have to keep pushing it out all the time, because it's you're in danger if you don't. And so this knowledge is very important for survival. It's survival value. If you don't pay attention to things, it may be the end of you. And this has happened again and again. And of course, today we're not paying attention to a lot. And this says here, they don't seek wisdom even when she should rule them, and the beasts of the forest are waiting for them there. They fleeth from the shepherd. The shepherd could give them good advice and take care of them, but they run away. They know best themselves, and they destroy themselves by this agnoria. That's what he calls it, agnoria. That's right, ignorance. Now, so then the next chapter we have a flashback. Notice it has a title. The Record of Zenos, the account of the people from the time they left the land of Zarahemla. In Omni 15, 15th verse of Omni, you'll read about how they left. Remember how they went out and left Zarahemla. And the Record of Zenos, and he's the third generation after they left Zarahemla. And they were trying to go back to the land of Lehi-Nephi. And now they are in this position that taught all the languages of the Nephite. Now, Zenos is the son of Noah. See, they're living in an enclave. Now, we found out in the other one, Limhi tells how they've been completely surrounded by Lamanites. It's very interesting, the enclave. Well, we'll get to that here. Now, Zarahemla, we learn here already, was bilingual, because he says, having been taught all the languages of the Nephites. And notice how he starts out with a formal introduction, which is required. Now, we have hundreds of Egyptian biographies. The autobiographies, the most popular form of writing in Egypt is autobiography, believe it or not. And this is the formal beginning. I, Zenos, having been taught, that's exactly what Nephi says in the beginning. I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents, therefore I was taught in all the knowledge of his fathers. And same thing he says here. Having been taught in all the language of the Nephites. Notice the Nephites had their own language. They kept their dialect. And the Zoramites still have theirs in Zarahemla. And that still happens, of course, on First Mesa, which is, I don't know whether it's 4 or 5 acres. It must be smaller than that. But there are three villages. There's Tiwa, Shemangbi, and Tiwa at one end and Walpi at the other. And I said before, the village of Tiwa, they speak a totally different language than what they do on the rest of the Mesa. Totally different, right there. And they live together. They lived together for hundreds of years, right on the same mesa. Not nearly as big as this building, this whole side of the mesa. Well, about the same size. And I asked one of the Tiwa brethren, how many Tiwa are there here? And they said, oh, how many people speak Tiwa? I said, oh, lots of people speak Tiwa. He said, lots of people, 100 people speak Tiwa. But they kept their language all that time. So you can be sure that the dialects flourished here, and being scattered, as we find them in the Book of Mormon, all these migrations going out, settling here and there, that they're going to preserve local dialects and local languages that are mixed up in the proper names and so forth. But he's taught in the language of his father, and he knew where they had come from. Now, this is the flashback. He knew the old Nephite country, which had been taken over by the Lamanites. Remember, when they went out of Nephi Lehi, the Lamanites took over. They left it to them and went out, and Mosiah, and went out and joined the people in Zarahemla. And Mosiah became their king. But Zenos, he knew about the territory of the Lamanites that they'd taken over from the Nephi Lehites, and they wanted to occupy it again. That's exactly what they wanted to do, we find out. Notice he says, the kings wanted that one of the very few cases when the Nephites are aggressors here, they're Zoramites actually, wanted that our army might come upon them and destroy them. And he was sent as a spy to spy out the land, so finding that. And then we find out, this land after Nephi's departure, I say, others were absorbed into the Lamanite people, and after Mosiah's demise, and they reinforced the people of Zarahemla. Now they want it back. See, the descendants of Mosiah, they want the land back again. They are expanding. And Zenos, if you notice, is not a Rambo or a John Wayne. Note, it's wise to adopt the enemy's good things. After all, what do we adopt from the Indians? Corn, potatoes, tobacco, chocolate, cotton, all sorts of nice things. Of course, we had cotton in the old world. And in armies and in war, you always adapt what the other enemy has. So what the enemy has, because that's why armies get to be very much alike. You can't afford to let him have the advantage of a weapon anything at all that will give him an advantage for any length of time. You immediately have to copy it. That's the best way you do. You steal it and copy it. That's why this spying is so important before anything breaks out, to find out what they've got that we don't have, because that will give them an edge. And so armies always, after a very short time, come to look exactly like each other. Notice we adopted the German type of helmets in this war, the British type in the last war, German type. But the only thing, the first thing we wanted when we got in Normandy was something the Germans had that was far better than anything we had. It was their field kitchens. They had these big pots of lentil soup cooking, marvelous stuff, very nourishing, hot and so forth, so much better than our tricky little K rations with all their high-priced packaging and so forth. What a lot of nonsense. The best thing you could do, so the command was, go out and see and steal all the field kitchens you can find. So all through, all through the World War II, we were fed on German rations in German field kitchens, because they were so much more efficient, so much more simple and effective than we had. So we adopted them. There's no shame in that, you know. And so he sees that they have some good things. Now, why waste it, he says. And let's make a treaty with them and see if we can't make some arrangements. But we see the leader was Rambo, and he wanted Zenith to be executed for treason. And see, he wanted to give aid and comfort to the enemy, which is the definition of treason, so he wanted to get him. This was rough and tough. They had a wild melee, and the breaking up of these groups is a very common thing. Of course, they fight, leaders fight, and breaking up, it's a long, tragic story, among the Indians, but elsewhere too. And it was a wild melee, and it just wrecked them. They had to return crestfallen. It failed completely. They had to return crestfallen to Zarahemla. You think of Jamestown, they quarreled among themselves, that was the end of it. You think of the Donner Party, they quarreled among themselves, that was the tragedy. Very few survivors, the only one eminent one was Mary Johnson. Marysville, California was named after her. She was a Mormon, instead, the only Mormon in the troop. And she survived and went down the Feather River and the American River there, and there is Marysville. But that happened to the Donner Party because they quarrel among themselves. And this is recently, there's a story of a new book out called The Last Place on Earth, the story of Captain Scott and a Munson. But Scott, a Munson, did it easily. He got to the South Pole, not easily, but he got there. There was no quarreling or fighting among them. They were in high spirits. But Scott was a very authoritarian person. You did what he said and nothing else. As a result, they all died. He became the great hero, though he didn't get to the South Pole until after Amundsen. Amundsen did it because they fought among themselves. He was pulling rank. They were always fighting because they were various officers and so forth. It's a sad story. But this is what happens here. There was this bloody melee. The father fought against father, brother against brother. The greater number of our army were destroyed, and quite a group. And then they returned, they returned crestfallen. But he is still overzealous. He is gung-ho. He's not to be discouraged by that. And colonists and miners are not, you know. They always go again and make another try. And this is a nice psychological touch, this third verse, you see. Zenith himself wasn't so idealistic as he was greedy. And notice, he being overzealous for the land of our father, he started again. So he organized another company, going to be run by himself. And he soon ran into trouble because it was impulsive. They weren't properly prepared. Just like Scott and his group in Antarctica, they were smitten with famine, and they were slow to remember the Lord. They were not up to it. They didn't have the necessary preparation here for this. We find in 721 here that Zenith, who was made king over the people, he being overzealous to inherit the land of his fathers, he just couldn't wait, you see. And so again, you see, we don't have heroes and villains here. We just have human beings, typical men. He wasn't as bad as the other leader, but he was bad enough because he wanted to. You can see it was a fight between Zenith and the other guy. Actually, the other guy wanted to eliminate him as his rival, because he immediately takes over, and he's a direct descendant of Zarahemla and the like. And as a matter of fact, he is the son of King Noah, and the grandson of. And the grandson of, Oh, boy. What's his name? Well, anyway, we'll get to it. Well, what do we get now? I see I've been taking too much time with these things, but I think it's rather interesting. So he wanted to make the takeover on the cheap here, and it didn't work. Say, like all prospectors and settlers, setbacks didn't stop him. He organized his own migration, soon ran into trouble, impulsive and ill-prepared, like the first Handhart Company. Brigham sent the message after message, don't go, October is too late, you'll get caught in the mountains. The leader said, no, we'll go, and it was tragic, as you know, in 56. The Handhart Company went against orders because they thought they could get there, and this is the sort of thing that happens all the time. Like Arctic explorers, they reached the camp marking their last advance. In this other one, they got back to the old camp. A sad sight, see the old, only bloody remnants there. And it marked their last advance and the defeat. And they're in country familiar to Zenith here. It's near a city where Ammon was to arrive later, incidentally. Well, he had no trouble in seeing the king here and making a deal. Remember, Ammon had trouble later on because it's with him that Ammon has the trouble. So he met the king and they made a deal. Zenith should have been above suspicion, should have been suspicious rather, but as he says, he was blinded by a promising real estate deal. He was overeager, so he could be taken in, you see. We say that Utah is a fraud capital, etc. It's only because people are eager to get a lot of money in a hurry. The king covenanted with me that I might possess the land of Levi Neva, which is what he wants, and the land of Shimron. He commanded his own people to depart. Now, that's a funny thing. That should have made him very suspicious, see, could take over, but we see, and that was a common procedure in ancient times, incidentally, to move out and make way for other people to occupy. Oh, a classic example of that is in Cedar's Gallic Wars. The Gallic tribes were doing this all the time. They were a big outfit. Well, here's an explanation of the king's behavior in verse 8, because why? The land was run down. It needed a lot of rebuilding and repair. And the Nephites were industrious, and the Lamanites were not industrious. If you look at verse 12, his own people were a lazy and idolatrous people. They didn't want to work, and they'd lied the land to get run down. We began to build buildings and to repair the walls of the city. They had to rebuild and repair things. And no wonder the king was eager to let them go in and take it over and fix things up, and then he would just close in on them. See, they're an enclave completely surrounded by Lamanites. I never used to have to pause for words that way. Something's wrong. Old age takes its toll. So they began it. And they began to till the soil. Now, here is an interesting touch here, incidentally. King Laman knew what he was doing. Notice it was the Nephite custom to work in the fields. King Mosiah did, King Benjamin did. The Nephites were agriculture right down to the ground, so to speak. And he knew he could trust them if he gave them the land, that they would make it flourishing, and then he could take it over. This is exactly what the Egyptians did in the Delta with the Libyans. And the Libyans took over five generations before the 22nd dynasty. The Sheshonq kids, the Libyan family, they were guards. They were made royal patrols, policemen, and so forth, and took over the land. But before long, the Libyans began to take over the land, and finally they ended up as their own dynasty. They took the throne. And this is exactly what Lamoni, the Egyptian king, the Lamanite king is afraid of, because it began to happen. It came to pass after we dwelt 12 years. See, 12 years, things were really flourishing then, and Laman began to grow uneasy. You can understand, he's not Lamoni, but Laman, King Laman. He began to grow uneasy. You could see why, of course. They're becoming prosperous, and this is what happened. I say, if the Libyans were able to take over Egypt, they were invited in to guard the frontiers and to cultivate the land and so forth. The same thing happened with Israel. When Israel grew strong, Pharaoh was afraid of them and grew jealous and cracked down and made things harder and harder for them. They finally had to leave. But they were invited into the land of Goshen, you see, to cultivate it. Then he wanted to exploit them. He put them all to work. This is the pattern you follow in ancient times, getting people to work for you. And, well, that's what we have here. So in verse 11, the Nephites began to get too prosperous. And what about the Palestinian problem? The Jews were easily able to go in and take over militarily, but the Palestinians had been there for many centuries. They were quite competent tillers of the soil, and that's what's happened today. If they give them all they want, they'll become just as powerful because they're increasing much faster. They're having children much faster than the Israelis are having children. And they're really worried about it. So what can you do? You've got to put the lid on, and naturally they react and so forth. But this is the same pattern. the Israelis didn't let them in. They were in already, but they allowed them to live in certain enclaves, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and so forth. They're taken over. And the same thing is happening here, Palestinian travel. And it's the 12th verse, it's the classic confrontation between nomad hunters and farmers. Both of them work hard, but they work hard at their own thing. The nomads have a rough time. They wander eating the grass and so forth, but they take cities and farmers and take serfs and slaves, and they put them to work and exchange with each other as gifts. And the farming goes on, but it's their serfs that do it. See, it's the patres and the plebs in Rome. The same thing happened. So they wanted this sort of an order. And they were desirous to bring us into bondage for that very reason, that we'd work for them, you see, because they had the upper hand and they'd hold us, and that's the feudal system, of course, the Lord and in his power and so forth. The Norman laws against the Saxons made it a capital punishment, and what a capital punishment for any Saxon to own a weapon, to own a bow, in fact, as a matter of fact, the Normans did. And in fact, I say the punishment was terrible. It was an evisceration in the most horrible manner. If any Saxon had a weapon at all, they couldn't trust them. Well, they were more numerous and so forth. Well, they settled things later on, but they wanted to bring them into bondage for that reason. The Saxon laws did bring them into bondage. And the forest laws, they could no longer gather in the forest. They no longer had the village green. They couldn't have the commons anymore. The Normans took over everything and said, now you can go back to it again, but we take the profits of sharecropping sort of thing. Well, that's what good old Laman wanted. So here we have the people of Zenith forming an enclave completely surrounded by the Lamanites, just as we have the Hopis today in an enclave completely surrounded. See, their original reservation was quite large. Around it, completely surrounding it, is the Navajo reservation. Completely surrounding the Navajos are the whites, you see. And so what do you do if they have a lot of coal and oil and uranium there, and it's their land and their nation, the U.S. has a treaty with them? Well, you appoint the Bureau of Indian Affairs appoints a tribal council of their own men, and the tribal council decides that the land shall be given. Well, they made a law when uranium was discovered. I want to go into this. No Hopi should be seen out of sight of the Mason, because they might go exploring for it. They didn't get any of it. Then they passed another law. When others started exploring for it, no one with capital of less than $10 million should be allowed to explore for uranium. Well, this thing is going today. It's the coal and the oil, especially the coal right now. But so here we have it. Today we have the Hopis forming an enclave completely surrounded by it, and they've been reducing it, steadily cutting in on it, cutting in on it. And but the interesting thing is now suddenly the corporations say, we must champion the Hopis against the Navajo. They put them against each other, and the Navajo hasn't been out there for ages. They just do some grazing out there and so forth. So they put them against each other, they put them to fighting, and this has been going on in the courts, the claims of the Navajos. And of course, it's because they are going to prove that they're both incompetent of governing and so forth. And this is used as a front for the giant corporations. They've set the Navajos and Hopis contending in court and fighting with each other, so that they can take over the lands of both, which they are doing. Well, the Armenians want to be independent. They're an enclave. They keep quarreling with the Turks, and so that the Russians can control them that way, you see. And so this is the way things go. Well, there was a surprise attack. Well, we may go into this later. But this is a situation today very much like this. See, they're just completely surrounded with Lamanites. And what are they going to do? Verse 14 says here. So the Russia launch a surprise attack. A blitz, a real blitzkrieg. It was a raid. It was all ancient wars are raids. They're just going for get stuff. And the fresh invaders find everything up for grabs, a exhilarating victory, war victory pictures of the German movies and so forth, the move into Belgium, Norway and so forth. Surprise is the whole element. The Germans emphasize that very, very much. For 8 months, when I was Camp Ritchie, that's where Camp David is today, I was put to translating secret German documents from World War I. And they're fascinating documents, you see, whether they could use those, of course, different tactics now entirely. But the big thing, of course, is always surprise. Well, anybody will tell you that. The one thing a general should never do would be surprised, says Napoleon, and that's it. But there's a surprise attack, and the fresh invaders came in. Numerous hosts all at once. They attacked in force. Didn't mess around, you see. They didn't filter in or anything like that this time. It was a real blitzkrieg, and it hit them all at once, unexpected, caught them in the fields and their flocks. They ran to the high place, which they always do, to the Acropolis or to the capital, which means the highest place, which is a defense, and or to the castle. That's where you go. People in the fields, you run to the castle. That's what they did. They flee to the castle, to the city, to the redoubt, the Alta Moenia Roma, the Alta Moenia Roma. And they called from him for protection, and there were weapons awaiting them there, because Zenith had arms ready for them. He had foresight here, and he's going to have more later. And this is the Lord's plan in operation, read in the 70. Remember when he told Nephi First Nephi 2:24, it is, yes, he says, remember, I'll always have the Lamanites breathing down your neck to stir you up to remembrance. They'll have no power over you as long as you behave yourself. But if you don't, then this is what will happen, you see. And it did stir them up to remembrance. We were awakened to a remembrance of the deliverance of our fathers. See, this, to stir them up to remembrance, that's what the purpose of this was. And it did stir them up to remembrance, we read in the 17th verse. So the plan was in operation. And what had happened? A major Lamanite horde had been brought to a halt. The commentary is very interesting on the population. 3,043 against 279 dead. Now, if 10% of them were killed, that would mean there are only 30,000 male Lamanites the king was able to put into battle. If it was a 3%, now 3% is considered the minimum, at the very most, the male Lamanite population would have been 300,000, but it was probably 30,000, even 15,000, if it was 20% dead. And since it was the retreat, since they lost, but since they retreated, they could have saved themselves. Well, there are all sorts of calculations here where you can use some neat calculus and see which is which. But it was figured in World War II that, I know in my division we had to figure out, that in the average operation, 3% would be lost. 3%. But this was a disaster. They got beat, you see. And so this gives us a hint to the population. 30,000 for a nation, that's good. That's about what it would be, you know. Don't expect anything fabulous. Nothing out of Arnold Freeberg and all that nonsense, the gigantic super cities and so forth. Well, now, the next chapter, the subject is the quest for coexistence. Here, notice the necessary, in the first verse, very interesting verse, it was necessary to make a reassessment of the situation after what had happened. They were geared for peace, and it lasted for 22 years, but they had to be wary all the time of the Lamanite administration. They couldn't trust them anymore, not after that sneak attack, tells us here. We began to possess the land in peace, go back to their old ways, and cause that there should be weapons of war of every kind. Now they're preparing, you see, lest they should come upon us. And they kept a guard all the time. You see, the Lamanites are no longer to be trusted. They lost, but look out, they're dangerous. And then we inherited, he felt it was theirs, that's what he came for. Notice he says in the third verse, we inherited the land of our fathers for many years, for 22 years. Again, the question comes up, what do you mean by many? 22 years, if you didn't say, he said many years without 22, how would you know? Well, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, 6 years, what would you do? But it says 22 years. And here we get the normal Indian culture carrying on, typical Indian culture, farming with characteristically Indian division of labor. Notice, the men do specific things and the women should spin. Among the Hopis, the men spin. Among Navajos, only the women spin. But among the Hopis, the men do it. Oinkopi, there's a big cave. The old men sit there and they sing these songs as they weave away, just like Penelope at the loom. And that the women spin and toil and work in all manner of fine linen and cloth of every kind, while the men do the cultivating of the tilling of the ground. And the division is different. Of course, women make pottery. Among the Hopis, women don't among the Navajos and so forth. And that's the way it goes. And we had continual peace, the culture they carried on for 22 years. But then Laman died, and of course a new administration, his son was gung-ho, and the people are eager to go. After all, that's supposed to be their living. So he had no difficulty, I think, stirring up his people in rebellion against my people. Therefore, we began to prepare for war and to come up to battle. This, hmm?
Rebellion.
To rebel against my people.
Yeah, it sounds like the Nephites might have gained some kind of power if they used.
Well, yes, they resented. They resented the success after 22 years, the success of the Lamanites. They had no power over them, you see, and They would call it, it tells us why, because remember their traditions are that they'd been offended and that the Lamanites were the true masters and that Nephi was in a state of rebellion. And they always taught their children, it tells us a little later on, that the Nephites were rebels, that they had rebelled against the true authority that should be ours. So it's always preached to them as rebellion here. That's a good point to come out. I say these subtle things hit us all the time in the Book of Mormon. And he stirs them up to rebellion. Did we talk about this? So Laman dies, he given the nature of the society, they were champing at the bit. And they were adapted, in the 12th verse we see, to living by exploitation. The young man takes over, eager to get going. It was an easy matter to stir up his people between the Nephites and Lamanites, bordering on each other on all sides. He stirs up his people here to get them to make certain claims. And the 8th verse here, and this is what happens, 4th and 5th verses here. Stirred them up to rebellion against my people. But he'd sent out spies and caught on, so for the time is up now. But see, this sort of thing goes on. It's that the Book of Mormon should still be going on and still be relevant and still the same people, which we thought had disappeared into nothing. But these resurgences are strange, you know. All my youth I studied Arabic, and I was Professor Popper at Berkeley. I was Professor Popper's only pupil. Nobody knew anything about it. The Arabs were the poorest, forgotten people. They were nobody. They were just dirt poor. They just lived on the sand and had nothing else. Now they're the richest people on the earth. This happened about five years, you see. All of a sudden, this big change, and these become great princes and powers. Everybody's petitioning them, and they have this. They can buy up anything they want. They bought up the Salt Lake Airport and this sort of thing, everything west of that. But what a surprise. You'd never expect it. The last people in the world you'd expect would be Arabs. We'd never hear from them again. They died hundreds of years ago. You know, and here, all of a sudden, they own the world. So these things are still relevant, happening, though they seem to be happening on a very small scale down there, these people, but it is very serious what's happening anyway. And the Lord knows what's going on. Well, I don't know whether we should go on bit by bit, but the Book of Mormon is really worth considering in this regard. And people say, what should we read in this course? Well, there's plenty to read here. And as I read that passage from Brigham Young, you want to find out for yourself. But the Bible is relevant here. We get into the prophets. We had to read Jeremiah for the first part. Now Isaiah is going to be extremely important later on. But we also have the Doctrine and Covenants. We also have the Pearl of Great Price. And they all go together. And you'll notice in your book you have footnotes giving you references to other sources. They're not the very best. You notice it's an apparatus down here. Why don't you look those up once in a while, and you see how things hang together in this story. And because they'll mention Bible parallels, they'll mention Doctrine and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price, and so forth, and other passages in the Book of Mormon. Here I see he's quoting John 13:13, 3:3, and Titus, and then 1 Nephi. If you just look up the notes in the apparatus at the bottom of the page, I think you have a fuller one than I have now, then you'll have plenty of reading, and if you think about it, you'll find it entertaining. And don't go to bed before 3:00. That's the way it used to be, you know. Anybody who went to bed before 3:00 was just being lazy. Well, you can go to bed at 2:00. Make sure you keep going till then.